Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Atlanta, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Chicopee.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey, and we want to thank you tonight. Going back to doing something you haven't done in quite a while, you'll be subbing for Lucy, who went back home to London over the holidays. She'll be back after the first of the year. You'll be back to doing a blonde joke, which we appreciate that. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, Keith Haley, for the Jumbled Justice Radio Show. The few news items today that are jumbled in terms of their thought and logic. So we'll talk about a few of those. And we're going to do it again. Johnny Cash, he sang that song. I couldn't shut him off, by the way. I clicked him about four times and he wouldn't stop singing. So he must have really wanted to get that song out tonight. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for being here. We might actually have Mike read us some news stories, but I'm not sure. I don't want to spend a lot of time on news tonight because the topic is very interesting. Mike Bowden is the speaker. We're going to pick off of Book TV one more time, but he wrote the book Worm, the first internet warfare. And you say, well, I don't know anything about that, Haley. What are you doing that thing? Well, I don't. A lot of people don't, and he didn't either. And a lot of these people use terms back and forth about this type of viruses and worms and infections and world internet warfare and all that stuff, and they don't know exactly what they mean either. You'll hear him talk about that. Very interesting discussion. And if it's kind of like a one-time thing for to hear about this kind of stuff, this would be a good guy to listen to because he understands explaining it. And he's funny when he talks about when he was learning about this stuff, he had to ask questions continuously. So anyway, that's what we're going to do tonight. Our show's about the worm, but we don't mean the kind that crawl around. We're trying to discuss news events, issues, and things in the field of criminal justice. And, of course, related to that is the whole business of cybersecurity. I guess you saw China. What did China do? They hacked a whole bunch of folks here in the United States, hundreds of thousands of places. And that's something to think about in the future because there can be attacks where they can shut off whole systems, and that could be military and protection services and all sorts of things. But we dedicate this show to these police, courts, corrections, juvenile justice, firefighters, I suppose, too. We could put them in there. They do a wonderful job. We're very proud that they work for us. And we hope they're well compensated for that, not just in money, but in praise that they in thankfulness they receive from the community. What we try to do is look inside criminal justice and take a close-up look at its professionals. And I told you what the show's about tonight. I think you're going to enjoy this. Like I said, it was a one-time little experience to hear about this type of warfare that's going on. You'll know, you'll hear the terms black hats and white hats, that type of thing. And I just finally finished reading Kevin Paulson's book. He's number one hacker, and for a long time, and now he's executive editor, top editor for Wired magazine. You know, it's an interesting kind of world we live in as we get tied closer and closer to the internet. I guess you're reading all those news stories about these young people who like being on the internet and being better than being off of it. They like their online personality better than their actual personality, of course, which is actual nowadays. So anyway, you're listening on Blog Talk Radio. Why don't you get your own show? You could start that as a New Year's resolution. You could start a fitness show or a diet show. Oh, doesn't kind of get you. We haven't even had Christmas yet. Yes, Christmas, we'll use the word. We haven't even had Christmas yet, and you see the diet and exercise programs coming on already, and they're advertising, you go here, you go there, you eat this, you don't eat that, buy my book, of this type of thing. Wait a minute, Audrey, you have a diet book, don't you? Yes, you do it, and you can get yours, you can buy it on Amazon, or you could get it free on archive.org and listen to Audrey read you the book called The Three-Bowl Diet. That's all I'll say about it. What is possible, though, about this radio business is any one of you can have your own radio show. Why not? Get on there and say something stupid. We do it every week. No, you'd have something to contribute. It's a marvelous mechanism. Free, broadcast worldwide, unlimited number of listeners, and it costs nothing. Said that 20 years ago, people thought they would have called the emergency squad to have you sent to a mental institution. But it's absolutely free. So get your own show if you don't like this one. Okay, another comment came in about last week's show. Well, we're going to have to keep that show. All right. You can call in if you want to on 347-996-5983. I'm actually thinking about somehow employing this Skype business or the Gmail video talk and maybe having a couple speakers on that way live. But I'll have to explore that. It'll probably take 20 minutes of study to figure out how to do it. So the call-in number is 347-996-5983. 347-996-5983. If you want to do that, do during the news segment. Well, Audrey, how about a blonde joke? I think you got one, right? Let's go for that.
Professor Haley, our blonde joke tonight involves two occupations who get to see each other a lot. Those two are over-the-road truckers and the table and counter servers at truck stops. I hope our listeners will enjoy it. Here it is. A trucker came into a truck stop cafe and placed his order. He was a bit impolite. He said, "I want 3 flat tires, a pair of headlights and a pair of running boards, and I need it quick." The brand new blonde waitress, not wanting to appear stupid, went to the kitchen and said to the cook, "This guy out there just ordered 3 flat tires, a pair of headlights and a pair of running boards. What does he think this place is, an auto parts store?" "No," the cook said. "3 flat tires means 3 pancakes. A pair of headlights is 2 eggs sunny side up, and a pair of running boards means 2 slices of crisp bacon." "Oh, okay," said the blonde. She thought about it for a moment, and then spooned up a bowl of beans, and gave it to the customer. The trucker asked, "What are the beans for, blondie?" She replied, "I thought while you were waiting for the flat tires, headlights and running boards, you might as well gas up."
Okay, that's a good one. We have a news story tonight about firearm. Thank you, Audrey. That's a good one. I think I've heard that one before. But anyway, the Ohio Coalition on guns, against guns, what do they call themselves? Yeah, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms, excuse me, not guns. They have a message that all of us need to hear, especially during the holidays. They would like the crooks in the cities and the counties and the rural areas to turn in their firearms after they hear this message.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And I know that message always falls in the right ears, and probably guns are being turned in within the hour after we hear that. Here's our green tip for the night, and it's also, you know, first of the year exercise starting. People have New Year's resolutions about exercise that will last about 4 days for most of them. But we've done this one before, but I really like this one. This one is for smart people. Walk yourself to an old age, it says. Every mile you walk is estimated to add 20 minutes to your life. Can you believe that? Walking is also the greenest transportation method there is, as every single journey in your car, taxi, bus, or train contributes to pollution. So walking doesn't contribute to pollution yet. I mean, we haven't found out a way. Of course, the soles of your shoes could be moving pollution around. Well, no, let's don't get into that. But a very smart thing to do is to walk. It's the best exercise there is. And we have, you know, if you go back in our history, we have walkers that have walked and walked. And Ed Pace and Weston walked across the United States 9 times. Can you believe that? 9 different times. So give yourself a shot at it. If you're going to have a new exercise program, get out there and walk. All right. Let's take a look at some criminal justice news, and some of this is interesting stuff. Let me get this in here. Yeah, let's do it right here. And the first story tonight is kind of an interesting one. It's about local cops getting Homeland Security funds. And they're talking here about Fargo, North Dakota. A decade of billions of dollars in spending in the name of Homeland Security has armed local police departments with military-style equipment and a new commando mentality. But has it gone too far? Becker and Schultz of the Center for Investigative Reporting report, Fargo treasures its placid lifestyle, seldom pierced by mayhem and violence common in other urban communities. North Dakota's largest city has averaged fewer than 2 homicides a year since 2005. Can you believe that? And there's not been one single international prosecution for terrorism in the last decade. But Fargo is equipped with all kinds of things. Every city squad car is equipped today with a military-style assault rifle. Officers can don Kevlar helmets, able to withstand incoming fire from battlefield-grade ammunition. And for that epic confrontation, if it ever occurs, officers can now summon a new $256,643 armored truck complete with a rotating turret. For now, though, the menacing truck is used mostly for training and appearances at the annual city picnic, where it's been parked near the children's bounce house. Most people are so fascinated by it because nothing happens here, says Carol Archibald, a Fargo resident and criminal justice professor at North Dakota State. There's no terrorism here. Like Fargo, thousands of other local police departments nationwide have been amassing stockpiles of military-style equipment in the name of Homeland Security, aided by more than $34 billion in federal grants since September 11, 2001. Can you believe that? Can you believe that $34 billion in these local police departments? And I think the clothes kind of make the banker. When you get all dressed up for combat and war, I think it makes you act differently. I really do. And, it's a long thing. Mike, don't get me started, but I don't like this idea of our soldiers running around, when they're not out in the field. I don't like them running around in fatigues. I think that's weird. I think they ought to be in a dress uniform like they're supposed to be. I don't know. Can the Marines do that? We can never do that in the Marine Corps. You could not wear your fatigues off the base or unless you're in combat or something like that. I don't know anything about that anymore. But anyway, speaking of your tax dollars, this is overstated. I'm going to be short on this one. But I could not resist this. Every time I get tempted to go out and buy a Chevy Volt, excuse me, that's the government's General Motors plug-in electric car. The Volt now, we're thinking, can cost as much as anywhere from $50,000 to $250,000 in state and federal dollars. When you go out and buy the thing, I don't know what a Volt costs. Anybody have any idea? $50,000, $60,000, $48,000? I'm not even sure what it costs. But it's been subsidized so much for states to employ people and to do this and that and to get that product out on the line, that each one could be subsidized to the tune of $250,000. And I knew that our federal government, us, I didn't know that we, I knew we were part owners in General Motors, but I didn't know we owned 26% of it. So a little over a quarter of General Motors is actually owned by the federal government. And I guess that's why they call it government motors sometimes, just in fun. But isn't that incredible? And the Volt, isn't it, you know, something like 38 miles where you have to charge it again? Don't quote me on that. It might be 58. But a little weird. Does it have an engine in it, Mike? Audrey? Emily? Don't know. I don't know either. I'm going to look up the Volt. I haven't had a Volt yet. I've had about everything else. Somebody told me also that they explode once in a while. The engines explode. If there's electrical storm and things like that, ooh, I don't think I want to be in that. Well, you know the Occupy whatever city in the nation movement, Occupy New York, Occupy San Francisco, Occupy Los Angeles. L.A. now is millions of dollars in expenses and debt because of the Occupy L.A. movement. And the mayor finally got ticked off about it. He moved them out finally. Was that just about a week ago? These agencies have been ordered to calculate what was spent on Occupy LA protests, the city departments are. Repairs to the city hall's lawn, where the Occupy group set up camp on October 1, will require an estimated $400,000. The police action to clear out the encampment on November 30 cost more than $700,000. Gee, many tourists. $700,000, so that's already $1.1 million. Additional expenses are attributed to hauling away debris from the camp and cleaning up graffiti that defaced city marble walls and trees. And so Mayor Villaraigosa, he says that more budget cuts will be necessary to offer, but that's probably what they wanted, wasn't it? They probably were interested in, you know, causing more debt and that type of thing, and that's what they were into. Well, this is a one-liner, but the United States is going to reduce its troop levels, its National Guard troop levels on the Mexican border. Now, does that mean everything's fixed? No, it just means that they could do better. They're going to have aircraft and surveillance, flying surveillance, and it said it will increase their response time. Somehow, having been there on that border, I don't understand how that's going to work, but we'll have to see. But I think it must be election time, right? Take the troops off the border during election time, and some illegals may, in fact, vote for me that might not have voted for me in the past. I think they might. Anyway, that's kind of interesting. This is a terrible case, and then I think we'll go to our story. But this is the case where the man was cleaning his muzzle-loading rifle. This comes out of Fredericksburg, Ohio. And he shot the gun, accidentally shot up in the air, and he kills a 15-year-old Amish girl about 1.5 miles from where his gun went off. Rachel Yoder was her name. She was shot in the head while she was traveling in her buggy. She had attended a Christmas party for employees, most of them under 18 years old, at an Amish produce farm, and was driving home alone when she was shot. Isn't that incredible? And the people, the neighbors said they heard a shot, and the family themselves turned this in. But Holmes County Sheriff Tim Dimmerly says her brother found her after he saw the horse walking in circles, and they went up to check. Authorities initially believed she had fallen out of the buggy and hit her head, but until the hospital test revealed the gunshot wound. They traced a trail of blood along the road for about 3/8 of a mile into Holmes County, in an area of farms. And Zimmerly said the gun cleaner's family came forward and his neighbors reported hearing a shot. The man had fired the shot in the air about 1.5 miles away. Isn't that a terrible way to, my gosh, what a way to go. And there are no charges going to be filed against him. I thought something like that, there have to be some type of, wouldn't it be a manslaughter type charge or something like that, fourth grade or fourth level or something like that? I mean, you know, you commit some kind of accident, but I guess they're saying, if you're shooting outside, shooting up in the air, then it's not an accident. But if you're shooting up in the air, you also have to be careful about how far the bullet goes. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But what a terrible thing! Not only this time of year, but for a young woman to die that way. So when people are cleaning their guns, how many times have gun cleaning accidents occurred? I knew a cop had shot himself in the hand. He met his wife in the nursing. She was the nurse in the emergency room, by the way. And he is a top shooter and used to win shooting matches in this major city police department. Anyway, terrible, terrible case. I got more news stories, but I think we'll hold some of those until next week. And let's go right now and hear the story about the worm. Mark Bowden's book, The Worm, The First Digital War. And you'll hear Bowden talk about Conflicker, the computer worm. They had a name for it. They always have names for them. And he's contributing editor of Vanity Fair magazine. He worked in other places I'll talk about here. But his other books are Black Hawk Down, which I think was turned into a movie, and Killing Pablo, and The Guest List. What's it called? Guests of the Ayatollah. So I think you'll enjoy this. And he tells you about naivete. He says he was as naive as you could get when he started doing this thing. So let's hear Mark Bowden talk about his book, Worm, The First Digital War.
Talks about Conflicker, the computer worm that infected more than 7 million computers around the world in 2008 and 2009. This is about an hour and 10 minutes.
Several parts. I'm going to do a very brief introduction, and then Mark is going to talk and do a brief reading, and then we're going to have a Q&A, and then I think cards are going to come up, and we'll try to make this as inclusive as possible. For our discussion tonight, Mark Bowden is a journalist who, of course, you probably all know, is the author also of Black Hawk Down, and you'll probably also know it was the basis for a 2001 movie directed by Ridley Scott. Mark was a journalist first. From 1979 to 2003, he was at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and for three seasons he covered football. Is that right?
That's correct.
Over the years, he's written for The New Yorker, for Men's Journal, Atlantic, The Atlantic, Sports Illustrated, Rolling Stone. And I have to mention that Wikipedia notes that he was inspired to embark on a journalistic career by reading Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. I was inspired by the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test as well, but not to become a journalist. And in addition to Mark, we have one of the characters from his new book, T.J. Campana, who, to my mind, is as close as you can get to a digital Sherlock Holmes. He is also the senior manager for investigations at Microsoft's Digital Crime Unit, and he just gave me this great little sticker. Maybe he has some extra ones. And he has many tales to tell. Before Mark talks, I wanted to just talk a little bit about our subject. So the history of the worm, the term, probably most of you are familiar with, but just let me set it out. It originally came from a really wonderful science fiction novel written by John Brunner in 1975, in which he posited something called the tapeworm. And the wonderful thing about that book, in particular with respect to Conflicker, is that he sketched out a authoritarian regime that controlled their society through basically an omnipresent network. And the rebels loosed a tapeworm, and the only way the regime could get rid of the worm was to take down the net, and thus they lost control. But we'll bring up Conflicker, I'm sure. You also probably all know that the first mealworm programs were experimented with at Xerox PARC in 1981 by two researchers there, John Chalk and John Hupp. Are either of them here tonight? Is John Chalk here? Ah, yes, good. So I was looking at your paper in preparation for this, and I thought it was, you know, so what's the difference between a worm and a virus? We go back and forth on that all the time because these terms originally both came from science fiction novels, and so they're terms of life. But in the original Shock and Huff paper, a worm is simply a computation that lives on one or more machines. So we can go from there, maybe get into distributed computing. But also, in addition to the sort of the roots of distributed computing being here, I wanted to talk about the roots of computer crime. And John Park is not here by any chance, is he? Of course. So if we really want to know about the roots of computer crime, I'm sure it's somewhere in the 1950s or 1960s. I was thinking about the roots of network crime. And to the best of my knowledge, and I'm certainly willing to be contradicted or corrected, but someone who is at the Stanford AI lab who has a great deal of authority told me he believed that the first computer crime was a drug deal done on the ARPANET in the late 1960s between MIT AI students and Stanford sales students. I would love that to be true. That's as much as I had to lay out. Why don't you take over this?
All right, great. Thank you, John. Well, thank you for coming. I'm particularly delighted to be on a stage with two guys who actually know what they're talking about. I'm an old newspaper reporter, as John mentioned, and about 30 years ago, a fellow named Jim Naughton, who was the managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, overnight named me the science writer. And this was a terrific thing for me because I was working in a suburban bureau, and then I got to come down and work in the main office. And particularly during the 1970s, the Inquirer was really one of the preeminent newspapers in America. So overnight, I was one of the perforce preeminent science writers in America, all of which is, of course, completely unmerited. It turned out that Jim, in looking for a new science writer for the newspaper, was going through the resumes of everyone on the staff, and he noticed that I subscribed to the Scientific American. And that's how I became a science writer. The truth of the matter is that I was an English major in college, and I had started subscribing to the Scientific American precisely because I knew nothing about science. And I thought, well, hell, you know, so much of the modern world depends on science and technology. I ought to make an effort to understand these things. And I think that magazine has gotten a lot better, but 20, 30 years ago, I couldn't read any of those articles. They always had a little, like, italicized intro that I could understand, but as soon as the actual article started, I was lost. So they had been building up in my closet for about 3 or 4 years, and little did I know that they would launch me to the heights of American journalism. But I discovered, though, that in covering science in the years that I did it for the Inquirer, that my ignorance was actually very useful because I was writing stories for non-experts, and I was ignorant enough to ask the truly ignorant questions that needed to be asked. So if I was interviewing a physicist at the University of Pennsylvania, I would ask a question like, well, what is an electron exactly? It was so effective for me that it became a kind of a philosophy of journalism. So whether I'm writing about pro football or a battle in Somalia or the Iran hostage crisis or in this case, a piece of malware, I begin really at ground zero. And if you were to actually listen to some of the initial interviews that I did in preparation for this book, you would laugh because I have to stop the people I'm talking to literally every sentence to ask what they're talking about. But my question is like, what's a router? You know, what's a server? What's an ISP? I mean, it was all completely foreign to me.
What gripped me about the story, though, was that over the months that I record in Worm, there was this fascinating intellectual struggle going on between very high-level computer security experts and some extraordinarily sophisticated authors of malware. The Conficker, as John mentioned, popped up in November of 2008 and rapidly began assembling one of the largest botnets in the world. And what was especially fascinating about this is that the ad hoc group of volunteers who started working together to try to corral Conficker, as they made moves to try and fence this thing in, the creators of the Worm would make counter moves. And this went on move, counter move over a period of 4 or 5 months. So I'm going to read you, at John's invitation, a little passage from Worm. And I'll set it up just by explaining that after several of these moves and counter moves, Rodney Jaffe, who's this wonderful burly South African.
Now, Mark Bowden talks about Configure.
We received a classified briefing yesterday afternoon, the woman said. So there's probably not much more you can tell us about it. That's really good news, said Rodney, his voice heavy with sarcasm. By now he knew without a doubt how foolish the establishment was. The woman's arrogance annoyed him. He started collecting his notes. Since you have matters completely under control, he said, then there's no reason for me to be wasting any more of your time. As he stood, there was a chorus of no's. Stay, protested one of the staffers. No, we want to hear it, said another. So Rodney sat back down. He took out copies of his PowerPoint presentation, which had been printed up on Newstar stationery. He handed them out around the table. The woman who had addressed him flipped through her copy and pronounced, yep, this is the same presentation we saw at the classified White House briefing yesterday. The meeting dissolved into laughter when the staffers realized that U.S. CERT had simply taken Rodney's briefing and presented it at the White House as their own work and classified it to boot. Rodney later confirmed it with his White House contact who had attended all three of the sessions. They just gave yours as their own, he said. So much for vaunted federal cyber defense. Thank you.
That's actually a terrifying note to start on now that I think about it.
Isn't it?
So, you know, there's certain analogies that appear in your book at various times. And, you know, early on, I think at a certain point you gave the sense of the Internet as Wild West, as some sense of that territory stretching out in cyberspace forever. And that, by an analogy to my mind, sort of brings up the possibility of the sort of definition of the cabal as vigilantes. And I was wondering, one, if you know, the vigilante term works, is it correct? Of course, I'm asking both of you. And then the follow-on question is, you know, since the Feds aren't doing very well, are the vigilantes sort of the last best defense in cyberspace?
Well, they certainly were in this case. And I think, actually, the guys, and TJ was one of them, can verify this, were a little uncomfortable with the designation cabal when someone looked it up and realized...
Vigilante.
Someone realized that the actual definition implies a kind of illicit or illegal activity. And so they subsequently dubbed themselves the Configure Working Group. But it's just like if you're the fat kid on the playground and people start calling you skinny, there's just no way that you're ever going to get rid of that. So they continue to be, even amongst themselves, to call themselves the cabal.
TJ, would you take issue with the notion of vigilante?
I think vigilante is not the right term. I think Microsoft's been called vigilante in some of the operations that we've done, despite the fact that we've actually gone to court and got legal authorization to do what we do. I think it was more of kind of an awareness for most of us. That there's a growing community of security professionals from around the world that were saying, hey, we can take this back and do something here, because at some level, the Internet's operated by the good guys. The bad guys are really dwelling in our domain. So really it was more of an assertion of the rights that we have around to protect our own systems. So I think vigilante is kind of like one of those like lightning rod terms that, you know, working in legal and corporate affairs at Microsoft, you know, what do they call them? Vigilantes. But it is true in the sense that it was an ad hoc assembly of, for the most part, volunteers who spent a lot of time and energy trying to mount an effort to protect the Internet from this threat. And they were, you know, there was no formal organization leading.
How hard was it for you to break down their, you know, post this when you started your book? Did you get their cooperation easily, with difficulty? Did it depend on who?
Everyone was fairly eager to help. I think they were a little appalled at my level of ignorance. But I have to say that they were extremely patient, and most of the folks who I worked with went out of their way to help me understand, to read drafts of the story as I was writing it, to correct my mistakes, to help me better understand the story, to tell it, because I think they felt it was an important story.
So I wanted to ask both of you early on, for your, I guess, Mark, what have you been saying about the state of security affairs in cyberspace as you go on your book tour, and then I want to get your gauge. I mean, what was Conficker an indication of in terms of where we are in terms of having cyberspace be secure? Are we entirely out of control? Where are we? I think, you know, TJ can answer probably better than I, but my impression is, and I was really surprised to learn it, how vulnerable the Internet itself was to a threat, a botnet of this size. And it seemed to me as though of the very nature of the Internet, which grew out of the sort of the late 60s, early 70s utopian spirit of freely sharing data, and at the time, you know, primarily by academic researchers and scientists, failed to really adequately consider how the very openness of the Internet, which is such a boon to the world, could also be a tremendous vulnerability and that there would be people who would take advantage of it. I think the fact that the federal government, in the instance of Conficker, was really clueless about what was happening and what to do about it was really shocking to me. My impression is that, in fact, President Obama in 2009, when he gave his speech about cybersecurity, he specifically cited Conficker as a case that demonstrated how ill-prepared the federal government was to protect even its own network. And I think so. Things have improved. That's my impression. You've seen a number of formal moves that have been made by the federal government in the last 2 or 3 years that have been publicized and written about. So clearly the government is more aware today than they were just 2 or 3 years ago. But there remains an enormous problem because it's a global issue. There is no such thing as a global police force. There really is no such thing as international law governing something like this. So, you know, it poses tremendous challenges. I think the openness of the Internet is both its greatest strength and its greatest weakness. You know, it's tough to really kind of manage usability, security on the same level. So really, the fact that the Internet is so open does make it vulnerable to these types of scenarios. It was invented in a different time, a different era. I think the Conficker incident really was kind of an awakening, and I will speak from Microsoft's perspective, definitely a new way of thinking about how can we address these types of issues. But thinking around how is it that all of these great technology companies, we're sitting in like the seat of technology right now, how can we not be more aware of what's going on and how can we play a bigger role as industry to try to tackle some of these problems? And really, I mean, honestly, when Rick Weston, you know, called up with a couple of my colleagues on the phone and said, hey, what is Microsoft doing about this? We were honestly like, well, we released a patch for that. You know, so we're sitting there looking at it, and, you know, we were having meetings, obviously, with trustworthy computing, the folks that and MSRC, the folks that do all the patching for our technologies. We said, you know, we can do something more here. We should be able to do something more here. And that was kind of an awakening for Microsoft in particular, and you've seen kind of our Mars program explode into all these different ways of thinking about cyber crime and the way people are using the Internet and Microsoft technologies. Before we get too far, Mark, could you give us kind of an epidemiology for people who may not sort of know the blow-by-blow of Conficker? I mean, just the first half about how it, you know, you did talk about it showing up in a honey glow. I guess it was John who talked about it showing up in a honey glow, but just sort of describe the beast here.
Well, the worm itself, it popped up on Phil Porras at SRI's honeypot, his honey net, actually, and it was on his monitor. And one of the what happens is when a new piece of malware drifts into his space, a line will pop up on his monitor, and there's all these readouts sort of defining what this is. One of which is a column which indicates how well recognized this virus is to the major antivirus industry and the vendors, and this one was recognized by none. That's the first thing that got his attention. And then the next thing that happened was it was replicating so rapidly that within 24 hours, it was shoving every other piece of malware out of his honeypot. The only readouts on his screen were Conficker, 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 Conficker. He said, I literally had nothing else to work on at that point. What they discovered at SRI when they began to dissect it was that it was very, very sophisticated piece of malware. It was highly encrypted. One of the things that it did, which is kind of curious, was check to see if the computer it was about to infect had a Ukrainian keyboard, and it would self-destruct if the computer did. But basically, of course, what a worm like this does is penetrate to the core of your operating system
and replicate itself, send out and infect every other computer on your network, and also begin calling home to a remote controller. The remote controller, the way you would ordinarily kill a botnet is you would chop off its head. If you can intercept that communication, you can effectively kill the botnet. So to prevent that, the worm had an algorithm that generated randomly 250 new domains every day, so that the botmaster had to be behind only one of those 250 doors on a given day, whereas in order to, if you wanted to cut this thing off, you would have to shut down all 250 domains every single day for us. And so that was, you know, one example of the cunning nature of the thing. And Rick Lesino, I think maybe even here tonight, TJ mentioned him a moment ago, actually began buying up all those domains and putting them on his credit card, which gives you a sense of how ad hoc this effort was to try to stop it. Before we go farther down the path of the worm's evolution, I just wanted to get back to that question of, you know, what kind of strains we're in. A question for TJ. I have a very old email address, and I have a Postini filter in front of it. And since
what?
That's that.
I think most of the people here know my email address.
And since most malware, I take it, is distributed by botnets in the form of, the level of spam is some rough correlation out there in the world with the level of malware infection. So I remember about a year ago, a large botnet was taken down, and for a while, spam fell off. But I have to say that if I look historically at the number of spam messages that are caught by Postini every day, it looks like it's probably 10 to 20% worse than it was before that happened. Now, am I a good indicator of the state of?
It's a perspective situation, right? So the operation you're referring to is Operation B107, the Rustock botnet takedown. So we kind of sit back and we laugh at some of the reports that were coming in. You know, one of them was zero impact on spam. One of them was 5%. One of them was 10%. And one of them was 30%. So we kind of looked and we're like, well, what's the real number? And we kind of determined it was a perspective thing. So we called our friends over at Hotmail and we said, well, did we do anything good for you guys? They said, well, we see a drop-off of spam of like 0.07%. I'm like, well, I was hoping for a bigger number. The problem is that they have, a lot of the webmail providers have systems in place that prevent sending of spam from non-known MPAs. So really, they had been blocking a lot of the spam that was hitting already. So we had a small impact with Hotmail. With some other organizations, particularly private companies, they saw a huge drop-off because the big spammers would really be sending email to Hotmail because they knew that we were blocking. I'm assuming Gmail does the same thing in Yahoo. They had same similar countermeasures in there. So when we talked to our Hotmail folks, they say that they've largely managed the spam issue. But the thing that we saw when we were watching our honeypots attempt to send spam out, it was sending it out to a whole bunch of different domains. So, you know, we definitely saw Hotmail spam leave, but that spam would never make it into an inbox because of the filtering on our side. So, I don't know what the real number is. I know when we start to look at these things, and going back to your original question, I look at how many millions of my customers are being impacted by this malware, because if it's running Rustock on there, it's running something else, just based on our testing. So we look at it a little differently. Spam gives us cause to sit in a courtroom and say, hey, they're harming us. When I look at it, I'm also looking at how many of my customers are being impacted. So when we started to look at Rustock in particular, the analysis showed that it would actually reach out to a piece of our infrastructure that we could track. So it would attempt to download a patch from our download center in a very specific way. So we were able to fingerprint that. So we knew how many machines we were dealing with. So one of the criteria that we look at, you know, in the Conflictor case, it was a big botnet. Rustock was a big botnet. How many of my customers are being negatively impacted by this piece of malware? So I think the state is not great on the internet, but I really, in the past couple of years, I've really seen a surge in internet service providers and technology companies taking more of an interest, knowing that private companies can do more to protect folks. So I think the dark days are behind us. I need some type of wood. I think we're getting that awareness. So I think as we start to really understand that there's more things that we can do, we're kind of coming out of that. So at our last conference we had about 2 weeks ago, we've been doing conferences for like 10 years now. This is the Digital Conference Consortium on the heels of the International Botnet Task Force. We're starting to see more people talking about how can we be more operational? How can my company help? How can my company take down? I would love to see spam go away as a distribution mechanism, but I think there's a certain perspective that shows that might be the case, that there might not be any change, but we're still in the infancy, so we don't know. So this book is a whodunit, except I still feel that we don't know whodunit. And I just want to check in with you guys to see, you know, where we are. Your book ended at a certain point. There have been a couple of things that happened. So take me through where the law enforcement aspect of the worm is, and you guys feel that you have conclusive sense of who the authors were or are. My suspicion is, and I can't say with any certainty, that the authorities do know who was behind it. And I suspect that the difficulty in apprehending them has more to do with diplomacy, dealing with a foreign government, dealing with foreign laws and police agencies, than it does with actually finding them. What we do know about the authors of the worm, without having caught them yet, is that they are tremendously sophisticated programmers. And the reason I use the word the plural is that it's almost certainly not one person. Because the worm configure demonstrated such a high level of proficiency in so many different areas that it's literally impossible to imagine that one person would have that level of ability and that level of knowledge in so many different areas at the same time. So the likely culprit is a group, well-funded, probably funded by an organized crime syndicate, who set out to create a very large, very stable botnet, which could be used as a platform for all manner of mischief, a money-making platform. I mean, if you look at the early indications of how Conflict or the infection is being leveraged, strong ties to fake antivirus, strong ties to some type of affiliate program, the keyboard check is really interesting. Because nobody wants to be arrested by local authorities for compromising machines in their country. Really looking towards Eastern Europe to find out what that looks like. But it's one of those really interesting. I agree. We referred the case to the FBI early on. They've been working the case for quite some time. I know that they're working hard on it. I don't have a picture of the guy. Maybe I'm just enjoying the mystery too much, but can you rule out the possibility of the head fake? I mean, if you wanted to point to the Ukraine, what better way and what more obvious way than putting in a keyboard? Yeah, oh, that's definitely a possibility. And
as far as you can see, this is quite a mystery and an ongoing investigation that will continue forever, actually, as long as we're having a network like this, the Internet. It's very interesting stuff. I studied that kind of thing a long time ago. I was a good customer, one of the best customers Radio Shack ever had, and I got interested in that defense business a little bit, and then I got away from it, and now it's back, and these people are doing this are probably pretty close to genius. If they're not that, they're people that will work very hard to cause mischief and commit crime on the Internet, and these police agencies now have cyber crime squads, and it's big business on both sides. Okay, that's it for tonight. What we'll do is have Vera Lynn sign us off again, and we'll meet again. And Merry Christmas and or Happy Hanukkah to all.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll some sunny day. He's smiling, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know